Welcome to the IM Radio Network, where noted authority coaches, authors, and speakers collaborate and bring to you the best in radio, TV, and live events worldwide. And now, the IM Radio Network proudly presents the Dr. Simone Show with your host, Dr. Simone Reves. Get ready to go. Interactive.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dr. Simone Show, The Mind by the Edge, where we speak of things involving human behavior, mind-body health, life experiences, consciousness, the changeable brain, and how to achieve business and personal success. These issues are vital for us to uncover and discuss because they can educate us, heal us, help us grow, and improve the condition of humanity and the planet as a whole, or so we intend. The woman that I'll be interviewing today, Dr. Geralyn Brosfield, is a very excellent choice for me explaining my background to you for a moment, because she talks about health and wellness. And it was my poor mental health in terms of thinking that put me in jeopardy of my physical health, in the sense that I faced death on several occasions. And the negative thinking I'm talking about were things such as, I'm stupid, I have to be perfect, I'm not worthy. Ho-hum kind of thoughts like that, which created a monster in the sense of leading me to develop a complete type A personality and perfectionistic behavior and just being pretty much difficult to be around. And what happened to me was that I pushed myself so hard that I became extremely ill, ended up in the hospital. And even when I was in the hospital at the very beginning, I was so driven to get out and start working again that I actually took all of the wires out of my arms that they were putting the medication in, and I tried to sneak out of the hospital. So that was one of my less than grand moments in my life. Luckily, I discovered a brain expert and started working with him and started exploring Eastern and Western modes of healing and developed a program which I followed, which led me into completely changing my ways of thinking and led me into things such as mindfulness, meditation, and living a much healthier life. So I was able to regain a very positive and productive life. So I have a lot to be grateful for today. And I'm very grateful for the fact that Dr. Geralyn Brosfield is going to be joining us here today. Her interest in medicine began as a child of missionary parents in the Sudan. And she pursued medical training at Loma Linda University, where the motto, to make man whole, resonated with her personal mission of providing holistic, comprehensive care for people. After moving to the Coachella Valley in 2002, Dr. Brosfield became known as a doctor who listens and partners with her patients to create total wellness. The needs of her patients led her to pursue further training in menopause, sexuality, and weight management. Always looking for tools to help people achieve sustainable lifestyle transformation, Dr. Brosfield created a network of coaches who walk with others on similar weight loss journeys. These coaches have assisted thousands in achieving and sustaining their optimal weight. During this process, Dr. Brosfield realized the need to reach the larger community with tools for wellness. It was therefore a natural transition to move into directorship of Eisenhower Medical Center's Wellness Institute in June of 2013. Dr. Brosfield sees her new role much like the conductor of an orchestra, with many pivotal partners working together in creating a beautiful outcome. In this work, she seeks to bring wellness into our community through accessible, relevant support of each person's wholeness in mind, body, and spirit. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Geralyn Brosfield to our show. Hello, Dr. Brosfield.
Good morning, Dr. Simone. Thank you so much for having me.
It is absolutely my pleasure. I know that you're going to be giving us some very valuable information, and you're going to be very helpful to all the people who are listening to us in the audience. And I thank you for taking time out of your what I know is a very busy schedule as well.
Absolutely. I'm delighted to be here.
So I wonder, in your work in wellness, how do you define the word wellness?
You know, I have thought long and hard about that. And in fact, as I started my work really predominantly in wellness at Eisenhower Medical Center, gathered a group of advisors and other what we would think of as health practitioners or wellness practitioners together, sort of to think tank that question. Mm-hmm. And what has really risen to the top as the most clear definition to me is resilience or adaptability. And so in working around the concept of wellness, or, you know, it's become kind of a buzzword, like wellness, we see that term all over the place. But what I think about that for each one of us as individuals, it's really having you or me have the most choices to react or maneuver or choose or spontaneously move into whatever results we need. And that requires the most adaptability. So I think of adaptability as probably the best way to describe it. It's kind of like if you imagine something coming through the air at you and you need to dodge or move. If someone threw a ball at you, the ability to move keeps you well in that situation. Or the ability to adapt to a situation gives you the most choice. And I think keeping our body, for instance, flexible so that, you know, we can bend or lift or dodge or adjust, that's one way of wellness. Having our mind be open and, you know, not having to use all of our resources just to sort of survive is another way that we can make sure that wellness is present for us. So there's many, many ways wellness can occur in our life, but it really, to me, has now become the most about adaptability and helping people be empowered to choose and make decisions to help themselves keep or develop or increase their adaptability.
Right. Well, I love that definition that you gave us. So it's adaptability, which basically is what got us here in the long run.
Right. So true.
Yeah.
And adaptability. The other thing I like about that you just alluded to is it's an evolution. It's not a destination where we can say, okay, I have achieved mental health or I have achieved the best physical form I can be in. It's a constant adjustment to our environment and our needs in order to be the most adaptable.
Right. Right. Absolutely. I love the analogy you used to dodgeball and also to the fact that it's a choice. We can choose to select different responses that are the most that will be the most effective for whatever we have that's facing us that we need to adapt to. So what led you in your journey from being a gynecologist to focusing on whole person wellness?
You know, I was born into a family that valued whole person wellness. I really think of my parents maybe as my first example, and then my husband, and I had gone through a college where really treating the whole person was sort of the baseline premise to the healthcare that was performed at the adjunctive institution to our college. But that concept of treating the whole person, not just their medical needs or not just their physical body, but also their emotions or their spiritual purpose or their stress management, all of those pieces, all the parts that make us a whole person, were very valued in my upbringing and also in my early education in college, just because of the schools I was at. Mm-hmm. And so when I graduated, actually from medical school, I had been part of creating some lecture courses and some practical courses that were around whole person care. So that was a good foundation for kind of moving into my OBGYN practice, where what I loved about working with women was that women guide the health of their families. And so when we look at who are the main choosers of, you know, what gets purchased at the grocery store, or who gets to see the doctor, or how the environment is in a home, women have a very pivotal role in all of those decisions. So I felt really good going into OBGYN, knowing that I was impacting family health and societal health by working with women. And I really wanted to normalize the experiences we have as women. So often we're told that we ought to feel a certain way, our bodies ought to be a certain way. And I went into OBGYN with the mission to just help people feel like they were normal in their own experiences.
Right.
And I loved that. It was it's an incredible field, and it's a privilege as a doctor to work with women for their health. But
right.
I think you alluded to the fact that our personal interactions with people or our own health often drive us in another direction a little bit, when you mentioned that earlier. And so in my practice, what I noticed was that over and over and over, women were really struggling around lifestyle change. They would come in and see me every year for their annual, and I could look back in my chart and see that the last time they were in my office, they maybe had made a statement like, I would like to lose 20 pounds, or I really am stressed and don't know how to handle that, or, you know, my life is feeling like I need to take certain actions to put it together in my marriage or raising my kids or whatever. And what I would notice is a year later when I would see them for their next exam, most of the time they had not been able to make an effective change in the area they wanted. And I felt really powerless, actually, as a doctor. I felt like a failure that I didn't have some systems that were helping them make change better. And the place that it was most poignant for me was around weight. Weight is such a catch-all for everything else. You know, our mental health expresses itself often in our weight.
Yes.
Our perspective about ourselves, like how we feel with our self-worth, often shows up in our weight. Inflammation from poor health habits shows up in our weight. Our relationships kind of show up in our weight. So weight was this place where all the women were coming in saying, I want to lose weight. And I knew it was many factors impacting their weight. And so I ended up really setting out on a mission to say, okay, if I could improve the things that work together for that. So it's true that when you lose weight, for instance, cholesterol gets better, or if thyroid is off, weight sometimes gets off, or all of those pieces that work together with weight and metabolism and healthy activities. I delved into studying those so that I could find a system that would work for my patients. And so that need of my patients was honestly what spurred on the next steps that I took to educate myself in methods that would be sustainable for lifestyle change. And I really worked on that, you know, from 2005 to 2008, I was searching for really good methods that I could start to put into practice for my patients.
Right. You know, it's interesting because you mentioned that the women were coming in year after year, not effecting change. And that was really the focus of my work previously as a psychologist and now as a coach, because that is what really called me to it. is seeing people not changing who desperately wanted to and just didn't know how. And so that's what prompted me to go into the fields that I went into, because I wanted to help people effect that change so that they could live the best lives that they could. So you and I are one in that sense, in our motivation. And, you know, you, what you were talking about sort of alluded to a question I was going to ask you later. Do you see any gender differences in the pursuit of wellness? Do you see that women are more interested in being well, or men are more interested?
That's a great question. It certainly, if we just look at the numbers, for instance, in my company that I ended up eventually working with Eisenhower, but keeping the company that I had developed that was around lifestyle change. And so my husband and I run that as our own company. And so when I look at the women, well, the numbers of people, for instance, who are our lifestyle clients, they really are about 80% women and 20% men. And the same thing is true at the Wellness Institute at Eisenhower. It's interesting. I think women, you know, a good analogy is thinking about asking for directions, right? You know, all the age-old jokes around men never stopping to ask for directions might apply here, because I think we as women are a little quicker to say we need help,
right,
or to be willing to ask for help, or to not be embarrassed by asking for help.
Sure.
And yeah, so I think it kind of applies. It feels like approximately 80% of my clients are women. And the interesting thing is men are much more straightforward. By the time mm-hmm. they say, I need help, they're like, tell me what to do and I'm going to do it. Whereas
right.
women will be like, oh my goodness, every time I, you know, think about eating potato chips, it reminds me of some history or something else. So I think we as women are way more kind of emotionally driven, or have a lot more components to what drives our behaviors, whereas guys are kind of cut and dried and say, give me the plan, I'm going to do it, and okay, I'll check in with you every Thursday. And we women have a little different way that we go about our changes that takes into account all of our life experiences.
All right.
A little more than the guys.
You know, that falls along with the stereotype about men being problem solvers and, you know, women talking and talking, and then men just wanting to figure out how to help them and just give them a solution for a problem.
It's so true. And sometimes we drive each other crazy with those talents, I guess.
Right. You know, and I think maybe another reason, and tell me what you think about this, that women are more interested in wellness is because of the weight issue. There's so much pressure on women about weight, you know, through the media and just through growing up in our society, that they may tend to be more concerned about the weight issue. Is that true? Or?
Yeah, I think it is true. You know, we're seeing it almost every day, where women are being judged about something about their body and or their appearance. And I don't think the same is true for men. And so we maybe even unconsciously have this aspect of us that expects that we need to look a certain way or fit a certain profile to be acceptable. And then that wreaks havoc in our own minds, in our self-acceptance and self-love, you know, that is a vicious cycle. Because if I'll tell you, you know, when I, in about 2008, I had been feeling so much like I was failing my patients that I was in the process of writing a handbook so that I wouldn't keep rewriting for every patient, you know, spending an hour looking over their dietary plans and their health support plans and their mental support plans. And a program, I learned of a program that I now use called Take Shape for Life. And in fact, we are now becoming a company. We are now becoming Optavia. That's our new branding and new name. And so
I've heard that. Yes.
Optavia is a health community around lifestyle change that's incredible in the support systems that people can access digitally or online or with the support of an individual coach. And so when I learned about that system, what was beautiful to me is when we look at systems that work for us to change as human beings, we want something, it's best to find something that has predictable results and is systematic. And as I started to learn that process, some of the key components that I think help us as women and men are, for instance, surrounding ourselves with a community of people that have a similar perspective. And I think when we go back to whether it's the differences between men and women or the drive, you know, in our society where women are feeling pressure, having a support system of people that have experienced similar things often helps us see some of the societal pieces that we might be blind to. I feel like we often operate, your question about the societal pressures for women impacting us, I think we often operate almost blind to those, and sometimes having other people who can see it more clearly than us helps us in that pathway of moving to better health.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I know also the importance of having social support in terms of achieving goals. When you have shared goals and values, you're much more likely to achieve those goals and to be successful.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I am familiar with Take Shape for Life. I know some other coaches who do that program with people.
Mm-hmm.
Let's ask you about our current, I love this, you had written, how do we navigate our current healthcare and in parentheses, sick care system and create our own health and wellness?
You know, one of the most clear steps, I think, that is maybe the first step, even as soon as in the creation of a wellness or health plan for each of ourselves, is to take that responsibility that it is our own responsibility and nobody else's. One of the things that I really work with as a physician is the education of each of us that you are the master or the designer of your own health. And one of the problems that I see with the Western medical system is that it's a system that urges people almost or encourages people to give away their power to somebody else. And so what I mean by that is, you know, it's not uncommon that I'll have a patient say to me, well, I can't see you because you don't take my insurance. Mm-hmm. Or my doctor told me that I had to take this medication, or I'd have high cholesterol. And in both of those situations, the person is giving away their own choice. And I often say to people, you know, if your insurance didn't cover, let's say, a basic test that you knew you needed, I could use an example of something simple in my world like a pap smear.
Right.
But if insurance doesn't cover that, you have the option of calling the doctor's office and saying, how much would it cost for me to come in and have an annual exam and a pap smear? And I can tell you that every office, and maybe I shouldn't say every, I've actually known a couple doctor's offices to turn patients away that wanted to come in and pay cash. But in general, I know, I was like, what's wrong with them? You know, the person wanting to pay you for their health care. But keep looking if that ever happens to you. But know that even if something isn't covered by insurance, most doctors or most healthcare practitioners or coaches would be willing to do a consultation with a person or provide a service for a cash price. Mm-hmm. And you can choose. So not giving away your power to the insurance company.
That's exactly what I was thinking is that people give away their power and they develop a sort of a learned helplessness because of our system. And when you were mentioning, my doctor told me to take this medication, you know, a lot of people don't do any research on the medication or talk to, or consult with anybody else. They don't, they just think, well, the doctor knows, you know, best, so I'll just go ahead and take it.
Right.
And I think we need to be, and I know you, you believe that we need to be active proponents of our own health.
It's so true. And I think the belief that anyone would know your body better than you do is complete fallacy in my mind. And I believe it's a fallacy. And I think, you know, you are the only person as an individual who knows your whole story. You're the only person who knows what's happened to you or why you might do certain things, or if you have some instinctual thoughts about why your body's doing what it's doing. Those are really important. And so when a doctor or a healthcare provider provides a recommendation or a prescription or a test that they want you to do, it's really very reasonable and, in fact, maybe even pivotal to self-preservation that you question or think about it instead of blindly following that recommendation. So kind of in creating your own way to navigate healthcare, I think number one is personal responsibility and knowing that you have the option of questioning and you deserve an answer. If you don't get an answer, I would say find another provider. And then secondly, developing a team or a posse. And what I mean by that is we often do more research about some very simple things like the mechanic that's going to work on our car than we do about our healthcare team. And I really, while I believe you need a doctor that you trust, I think they're not the only part of the picture. You probably need more than just a doctor. And I say that mainly because our health system has sort of siloed or compartmentalized what doctors do. It used to be, I think, it seems like it used to be that we had a lot more time with patients and the relationship, you know, was different.
Definitely.
And if you don't have that with your doctor now, you may have to develop some of those components by finding a coach and finding some alternative care providers. Maybe you need to have a really good massage therapist or an acupuncturist or chiropractor along with your doctor and coach. And then a team, you know, of people that are for you. We know from research that we become most like the people we hang out with. And so if you are hanging out with people that are unhealthy or are engaging in habits that you know tank your own goals, then making sure you start to develop some friendships with people or hang out with people that are moving in the same direction or at least supportive of the same direction as you want to go is sort of what I think of as the last step of that process.
Right. What do you think, you know, people can be told incessantly that they need to work on improving their health, that they need to lose weight or they're going to have heart disease and things of that nature. What do you see as the biggest block in people not changing their behavior and their lifestyles?
Right. I actually think it's focus. Their focus, their choosing. And what I mean by that is we can be problem focused. We can look at the problem. Like an example is I want to lose weight. So weight is the problem. Mm-hmm. Or we can be outcome or goal focused. And that is a much, much different frame of mind. So when we look at creation versus being problem focused, I think that choice of how you look at things is probably the biggest issue. And to give you an example, if I'm focused on the problem, so I'm focused, for instance, on wanting to lose weight, or I'm focused on wanting to decrease stress, as I see stress or weight as the problem, then as soon as I do a little bit of something to help that, so let's say I want to lose weight, that's my focus, and I lose 10 pounds, usually our human nature is such that we, as soon as we have some success, we let the foot off the gas pedal and we take less action. So as soon as I take less action, like I've lost 10 pounds, so now I say, okay, fine, I can go out for that pasta dinner to celebrate.
Right, well, to celebrate, exactly.
Action, it builds the problem back up.
Right.
And so it's kind of like, I think of it like a rocking chair where I'm moving forward half the time, and then as soon as I move forward, I reward myself and move backwards like that rocking chair that just endlessly goes back and forth.
Right.
The difference is if my focus is, let's say my focus is I want to be healthy because for a lot, you pick the reason. Every person can insert their reason. I want to be healthy because I want to be able to climb to the top of the tram road. Or
right.
I want to be healthy because I want to get up and down off the ground with my grandchildren.
Right.
I want to be healthy because I want to be able to trick or treat and not run out of breath and have to have somebody pick me up in the car. Or I want to be healthy because I really want to be able to be strong and exhilarated and walk on the beach, you know, or whatever your reason. But when you want to be healthy, then the fact that you've made some progress towards that goal doesn't mean that you would let off the gas, because there's, you want to pick a goal that is where you really want to be.
Mm-hmm.
If I lost 10 pounds, it wouldn't mean that I was healthy. Healthy
right.
might mean I want my relationship healthy. I also want my body strong and healthy. And if that's
right.
a bigger goal that can drive me with much more motivation than just the problem I'm trying to solve.
Dr. Brosfield, let's come back and continue talking about goals and goal setting. I think that's an excellent topic. What we're going to do right now is just take a short break, and then we will return.
Hello, amazing listeners to the I Am Radio TV Network. We thank you so very much for being here with us today. We wanted to let you know we have an amazing opportunity coming up. We have available broadcast time. If you are a coach, author, speaker, or a business person looking to get your message out to the entire planet, then please get in touch with us as soon as possible, and we will go over the various levels of participation in our network. Again, we thank you for being with us here today on the I Am Radio TV Network. Now, get ready to go interactive.
Hi, we're back. This is the Dr. Simone Show, The Mind Body Edge, and I'm here with Dr. Geraldine Brosfield, and she is an expert in health and wellness. We were just discussing the importance of setting goals in terms of making shifts in our behavior and improvements in our health. So what I love about the idea of goal setting is that the way we set goals can have such a huge impact on whether we get our outcome or not. You know, and I'm thinking, for example, of the very well-known published study, the accurate one, not the inaccurate one, about writing goals down, that mm-hmm. just the mere fact that we write them down can increase the likelihood of us being successful by 50%.
Right.
And there are other aspects of goal setting that can increase or enhance the likelihood that we'll be successful. Do you have any suggestions for us in terms of setting goals that can increase the success of what it is that we want to achieve?
You know, I suspect you and I use a very similar process and have learned a very similar process. I use the acronym, I think it may even, it's certainly often put up even as a meme on Facebook or other places, SMART goals.
Yes, the SMART goals.
Absolutely.
Right.
And I think the biggest thing about that is to be specific and to be and to time your goal. So,
right.
you know, for me, making the goal in a small enough chunk that I know I can achieve it. It doesn't have to be something so big that feels like it's way, way out there. It kind of has, for me, it sort of has to be in the near future, not tomorrow, but and not 2 years from now, but I have
right.
to chunk my goals down into something more like 90 days is often, somewhere within the next 90 days is kind of where I feel like my focus can stay.
Right.
So I usually try to make sure those goals are in place ideally, and I keep adjusting sort of my one-year goals and my three-year goals, but I try to chunk those down into what the next 90 days looks like and then make a goal with a deadline in that time frame. And then the other thing is to share that goal with somebody else. You know, that often is a really nice thing you can do if you have a partner or someone you live with, to share that, or if not, a friend, or even I have a great little group on Facebook that we all share our goals, you know, and it helps each other cheer. It helps us to cheer each other on and know
Absolutely.
That there's a day coming, you know, that,
right.
that person's trying to reach their goal by.
Right. It's very hard for the brain to sort of operate and just say, I'm going to lose 10 pounds, you know.
Right.
We have to be, and the reference to these SMART goals is that you want your goals to be specific and measurable and achievable. And what's the R?
Realistic.
Realistic, yep. Mm-hmm. And time limited. That time period is very important. And achievable, as Dr. Brosfield said. You know, when we have goals and we think we're about to accomplish them, we see a reward coming. The expectation of a reward causes the release of dopamine in our brain, which is like the feel-good neurotransmitter. So it makes us feel good, which increases the likelihood that we're going to continue on that same path and continue to be successful to get the rewards. So, you know, what you mentioned about the time and also in particular sharing the goals is critical. Being accountable to somebody else helps the chances of success so much. And the social support, as I had mentioned before and Dr. Brosfield mentioned, is really critical. You know, we are group animals, and we like to fit in and belong in groups. And if everybody is, you know, losing weight, we want to be part of that.
That's right. And I love that group accountability, even around something as simple. There's two things that I have my team at work do for me that I love, and then I do things for them. But one of them is I have them ask me if I've eaten, because my mm-hmm. tendency is to get busy and forget to nourish myself. And then secondly, I love it, and I ask them and my family to stop me with negative talk. So there's
yeah.
certain things that I have, some little phrases I'll say or things that are not helpful, because they keep my mind looking at the negative instead of something positive, or like it's not gratitude. So if right. I am in that phrase, those phrases with words, I ask people to call me on it, because I really don't want to propagate that perspective. I want to build an attitude of gratitude in the way I mm-hmm. say things. And so those are the kinds of things you can ask your friends or family or the people you're around to help you with. And that is huge for me.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really fantastic advice. When I work with people, I very much have them focus on their negative thinking, and I teach them steps that they can use to pretty much eliminate that negative thinking and replace it with realistic, more positive thinking. But the suggestion that we ask others to help us is fantastic. That's something I'm definitely going to have to note. That's a good one. Dr. Brosfield? Yeah. So what would you suggest as just good basic medical care?
You know, there's enough knowledge around some very basic testing that makes a huge difference in lifelong health. Things, and Pap smear I mentioned earlier is one I feel strongly about as a gynecologist. But generally, I would suggest that you have a physical with a doctor at least every couple of years. The times where there are heartbreaking situations where people come in and have a diagnosis that's really devastating for them are often cases where the person hasn't been seen by a doctor for many years.
Right.
And, you know, I certainly was raised as a doctor to say you need to go in and have an annual yearly exam. And I think that's the best. But if for some reason you can't do that, if you can even go in every 2 to 3 years, that's really important.
Right.
So So I think number one, have a doctor who is someone who can look at the whole picture and do a full physical exam at least every 2 to 3 years. I think that's one step. One other plug I will say, if you're doing blood work, because I do think it's helpful to have some lab work done every couple years at least. One of the things that has been a profound shift in my practice is to do what's called particle testing for cholesterol instead of our routine kind of cholesterol testing. It's extremely different in its predictability towards whether you're going to have a heart issue or not with the arteries. Absolutely.
How does that differ, testing from the regular test?
Sure. You know, when you do a regular cholesterol panel, so everybody kind of knows they ought to try to get their cholesterol down, and there's been huge movements from the American Heart Association, et cetera, about know your numbers and get your cholesterol normal. The problem with that approach is that our normal cholesterol panel that we've all thought about, where we have a total cholesterol and we're told an LDL, and I tell people L is, we used to think L is for lousy and H is for healthy. You want your HDL high and your LDL low. The problem with that approach is that those numbers have a 50% predictability ability for telling us if you're going to have a heart attack or not. And 50% is horrible. That's the same as flipping a coin.
That's right. That's
right?
Chance. Yeah, that's chance.
So when a doctor looks at your cholesterol and says, oh, good, it's fine, or oh, my goodness, it's not fine, it's just as good as if they flipped a coin. And
I'm sure you're going to shock a lot of people with that news.
I may, and I mean to. I actually really want to open that dialogue, because we need to think about some of the things we get stuck on in medical care are – there's a lot more better, there's more information now that's much better.
Right.
So with cholesterol, we've known for at least 10 years now that there's something more to the story. It's not just your LDL cholesterol that tells us if you're going to have a heart attack, because it's only 50-50. So there's a test now that is involved with cholesterol that's called particle testing or subparticle testing. And it's actually the most accurate one is an MRI of the blood. It's called the NMR test.
Okay.
And it actually tests for every particle size of cholesterol that we carry. And what we know is that the more particles you have, the higher your risk of having a heart attack, and that number actually correlates. If that number is high, your chance is high. If it's low, your chance is low. Very different than the 50-50 with the plain old calculated LDL. That's a math equation of what's left over in the blood when they do that other test that we've all had. So asking your doctor for particle testing, and if they say, oh, I can't do that, I don't have a contract with the kind of lab that does that, you can ask them for something called the APOB, A-P-O-B. That stands for apolipoprotein B. And the reason that works is that every piece of every particle of LDL cholesterol gets a tag or a label on it when it's made in the liver of ApoB. So if we count the ApoB and it's high, then we know your particles are high. And every lab in this country can do an ApoB.
Okay.
And if those numbers are high, then that is exactly the kind of thing that lifestyle completely turn around. I would say that lifestyle change can lower people's particle counts by at least one third.
Wow.
And then occasionally they may still need medication or other medical support, but most of the time, the power is in people's own hands to make a difference in that whole piece of the puzzle.
Right.
So I think some blood work and a doctor's visit at least every couple years is a really good foundation. And then I would say it goes back to the navigating the healthcare side of things is, even if you had to pay for that out of pocket, it's going to be an amount that's a few hundred dollars, not thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the basics of at least the medical side of people's care. And then going back to what we said before about building a team of people around you that support other aspects, because Western medical care doesn't support mental health or stress reduction or even structural whole body health in a way.
Right, right.
Not nearly as well as some of the other alternative care practitioners can.
Right,
right.
Exactly.
I just say, believe yourself. If your body and you are telling yourself something, believe yourself, and keep looking for practitioners that will listen to you.
You know, that brings up to mind conditions such as fibromyalgia, in which people have to often go to see 11 doctors before they're diagnosed correctly.
Right.
Because of a lack of education, but also because of a lack of belief in the part of many medical practitioners. And I the team that you're talking about, I so much believe in having a team approach that when I wrote several or a while ago a book on autoimmune disorders, and I wrote about the importance of having a SHOT, which was a self and health optimization team.
Oh, that's perfect.
Yeah. To have, you know, and to go through your life with and consult with them and so on, because there's so many avenues of impacting health and of approaching the study of health and treatment of health and things we do on our own. I'm sure one of the key components of an overall wellness plan that you would agree with are things like diet and exercise.
Oh my goodness, yes. I mean, when I was on the phone last night with a client who had never realized the connection between her eczema and her mood and her diet and her weight and her cholesterol, and they're all impacted by the exact same factors. And when we, you know, if I can adjust one thing for people in their health habits, it's usually around keeping their blood sugar steady, because that flows out to all of those areas I just mentioned. Such a huge impact.
Yeah, can you talk about, because I saw you, as I mentioned, I saw you speak before, and what really stood in my mind was you talking about the blood sugar and the rise and fall, the rapid rise and fall of blood sugar and the terrible impact that has on our body. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Absolutely. One of the other concepts that we've probably all been raised with in our society is that a calorie is a calorie. So we all, when we think about health and nutrition, think, okay, I have to control my calories, and that led to the low-fat craze and people counting calories and all and points and all kinds of things that didn't prove effective. So one of the reasons that a calorie is not a calorie is that what happens in your metabolism is that the nutrition that you eat, the food you eat, is managed by a whole complex system of hormones inside your body. And the most basic part of that is control of your blood sugar. And so if we look at what happens very frequently in our society, even when people are trying to make good choices and choose like a whole, you know, a whole fruit or a whole juice, for instance, like maybe they're choosing orange juice instead of soda, or they're choosing whole grain cereal instead of, you know, Fruit Loops.
Right.
When we eat foods that make our blood sugar rise, and don't have, and the way that that happens is that we eat foods that have more either sugar in them or things that turn into sugar. So whether it's cookies, cakes, and donuts, which we all would identify as sugar, or even a piece of whole grain toast, those foods, the starches and the sugars, all raise our blood sugar very quickly. Mm. And they raise it a lot. So some of you that have read the book Wheat Belly know that on the back it says that a person's blood sugar is raised by eating, that your blood sugar goes up more from two slices of whole wheat bread than it would if you ate 2 tablespoons of pure sugar. And so all of the starches raise sugar. So let's say I leave in the morning and I've had toast for breakfast. My blood sugar will have spiked really high. And then within 2 hours, it's going to crash again. It can't stay high unless there's protein and fat mixed with that meal, and fiber as well. So we tend in our country to eat meals that are very, very heavy on the things that turn into sugar in our system. And then we spike our blood sugar. We Within about 2 to 3 hours, we crash again and go what we call in medical care hypoglycemic or low blood sugar. Mm-hmm. When you have low blood sugar, your survival mechanisms tell you to hunt for food. And often, I know I'm not pleasant when I'm in that time frame. That's when I'm the grouchiest.
Right.
And so you hunt for food and you grab often the next thing that looks good and is close by. And much of the time, that again is a starch. So if that's at the coffee break in the middle of the morning at work, it might be that you grab a donut or a bagel, or some people will grab whatever else is handy. And it usually isn't a really quality choice of food. So if we spike and drop our blood sugars all day long, that right there is what sets up a hormonal pattern inside of us with high insulin, and it causes us to store fat and create inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basis of almost every disease that we could name, things like arthritis, heart disease, autoimmune disorders, Alzheimer's, diabetes, cancers, all are related to the environment of inflammation that gets created from that pattern of eating.
Right, right. And just, you know, I just think of the majority of our population eating that way.
Absolutely. We call it the SAD, the standard American diet.
Oh, and it is sad.
It makes people sad, right? Think about your mood or my mood when I've been eating crummy food. When I don't eat well, I'm much more likely to get into sort of the dumps mentally.
Right.
And we turn to food a lot of times. In fact, the very reason that we like to, our tendency is to want to eat, let's say, grain or sugar, is it spikes our serotonin most quickly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of a false high because it only lasts for a couple hours and then you have to reinsert more sugar.
Right.
In order to keep that serotonin high that we're kind of medicating ourselves.
Right, that we're craving.
False cure.
Right, definitely.
So, you know what I end up doing so much of the time, and I think one of the places when you were talking about how do we navigate and take back the power for our own care, one of the ways is to really continue to search for resources around how to nourish ourselves. And that can mean food, that can mean purpose and friendship and mental health and emotional well-being and spiritual well-being too. And what I end up doing a lot of is education around the food side of things, because you can stabilize your blood sugar by eating meals that are balanced with protein and predominantly vegetables, honestly. And keeping the blood sugar stable. And so the goal is that the blood sugar wouldn't even bump up virtually at all every time you eat, because it was so easy for your body to metabolize that food.
Protein and veggies. Okay.
Protein and veggies are the key.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the protein to eat, would you recommend that fish, or what would you recommend?
You know, there's a lot of studies that are showing that red meat may not be the healthiest protein for people, although one of the problems with those studies is they're not differentiating between a really healthy grass-fed cow, you know, that might have been raised in the fields of Montana as compared to beef that came from a beef lot and was fed corn and soy and grain.
Right.
So we know that the healthier the food, healthier your protein is, the healthier you will be. So the studies look like eating closer to a vegetarian diet and keeping fish in the diet, so kind of a pescatarian diet, looks like it's probably got the most support from the studies.
Mm-hmm.
But you can actually make virtually any dietary approach. So some people like to think of things like paleo or Atkins or vegetarian or vegan or those kinds of things. What I would say is to try to move your diet to be as much plant-based as it can be, and then make your protein sources as high quality as they can be. So choose grass-fed, free-range, really healthy meat sources. You want wild-caught salmon if you can choose that.
Right.
And then I happen to be a vegetarian and choose to be a vegetarian, but that means I really pay a lot of attention to how much protein I get every day, because most vegans actually become what I call skinny fat. They might not look overweight, but
yeah.
their body fat can be really high and their muscle can be really low because they're not getting enough protein consistently. So it takes extra diligence if you're going to do your dietary plan as a vegan or vegetarian. You have to be more mindful of not overdoing the carbohydrates and starches
right.
and really getting enough protein.
How would one find out if they are skinny fat? I mean, would that be body mass index, or how would one find out?
Sure. The body mass index, that's the biggest fault with it, is it doesn't tell you anything about your body fat. It just tells you if you're overweight for your height.
Okay.
So you would want to find what's called a body composition scale. The best ones are ones you stand on, not ones you hold, because the ones you stand on actually take into account your legs and your trunk, whereas the ones you hold just run the electrical impulse through your arms and upper body. You can do those. The Wellness Institute at Eisenhower has body composition measurements. Some gyms will be able to do that. They're called bioimpedance analysis or body composition scales, and
okay.
they'll give you a percent body fat. And for women, we want that percent body fat under 28%, and for men, it's better if it's under 20%. We know that disease risk goes up if the body fat percentage is higher than that.
Okay. Interesting. Wow, that's really valuable information. We're going to wrap up in a couple of minutes, but I just wanted to ask you if you have any favorite wellness resources, like books or websites or blogs
sure.
or anything else.
You know, there are a number of books that were really pivotal for me in my journey of learning. So I'll just name a couple different titles in case people are interested, and then an app that I like, and also let you know how to contact me. But from a book standpoint, a few of the books that were really pivotal to me, one is by Gary Taubes, T-A-U-B-E-S, called Why We Get Fat.
Okay.
Another is called Death by Food Pyramid by Denise Minger. Have you read that one?
I've heard of it and I've seen it, yeah.
Yeah. And then I really have appreciated Bill Davis's second book. He wrote Wheat Belly, and his second book goes even further into depth about lifestyle choices and how to impact lifestyle. And so his second book is called Total Health Revolution, and it's the author of Wheat Belly. And then another book by Dr. Wayne Scott Anderson called Dr. A's Habits of Health. Those four books have probably been some of the pivotal books that have been helpful for me. I also love an app called Headspace because I'm not a very good meditator, and I want to be, but I'm not. And Headspace is great because it actually does 10 minutes of time talking you through a meditation so that if you don't know what to do, you have help.
That's great. Okay, Dr. Brosfield, can you tell us how to get a hold of you?
Absolutely. So find me on Facebook if you want to. It's Gerilyn, Gerilyn Brosfield, Brossfield, and I will be glad to friend you and connect you to the resources that I provide in the community. I'm at Eisenhower Wellness Institute, and our website there is www.emc.org/wellness. And then my personal website with my husband around lifestyle change is www.drbrossfield.tsfl.com. And I appreciate the opportunity, Dr. Simone, to be with you today.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure, our pleasure. And we'll be wrapping it up. I just wanted to let the audience know, if you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at www.successbraincoach.com. And I will join you again in 2 weeks when we'll be speaking about mind and body youth, maintaining mind and body youth. Thank you so much and have a wonderful day. Goodbye.